Members, we're going to get started. This will be really the last of a sort of big committee meeting long information sessions. No promise that there won't be others, but at this point we're basically going to really revert to primarily the hearing bills and deliberating on those. Of course, some of those bills will require some, you know, in-depth background information, but most of our hearings from here on out are really going to be directed in terms of moving legislation. And that's perhaps a good segue to reminder to all of you, if you have bills that are out there in your heads or that you're working on, I really would encourage you to get them introduced as soon as possible. If we're not aware of them, if you can at least let my office know, our calendar is already shaping out between here and the committee deadlines. As you know, policy committees have the earliest deadlines in the legislature. And actually, Representative Growley, I was thinking about that last night. Why do policy committees even have deadlines? You know, I mean, policy is policy, and it's good stuff surfaces. So that may be a reform issue. I'll speak with House leadership at some point. You have some thoughts on that?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's because good policy tends to get vetoed. And if you send it out not packed in an omnibus bill, sometimes you don't end up with anything.
And that's unfortunate, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Good policy should be able to stand on its own. But nonetheless, what it means is that we're the earliest committees under stress to get legislation out, so our calendar really books up in the next few weeks. So if you have bills, please get them in. At the very least, let us know if they're not in, so that we can figure out how to put them into the calendar. And frankly, the longer it gets, you know, all bets are off in terms of being able to hear bills, and that's true, not just for the minority party, but for the majority party as well. So today, members, we're going to have a discussion with a variety of voices and actors, if you will, in our private sector community in our state. Representative McFarland and I had a conversation a few weeks ago about this, and we were kind of thinking about the same things. We sort of circled to each other in the floor of the House, and Representative McFarland says, you know, I have this idea. And I said, well, I have an idea, too. I've been thinking about asking you to provide some leadership on it. And so sort of this perfect coming together of this thought that we obviously hear periodically in this committee and other committees from good groups, you know, that represent our private sectors, but we rarely hear from folks who actually run businesses in our state. And so our thought was to put together a presentation about the relevancy of our K-12 educational system to the well-being of the private sector in Minnesota. And to do that, being able to offer a variety of perspectives and diversity of thought. And so I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I want to thank Representative Farman for working this agenda and the schedule today. And so with that, I'm going to actually turn over the gavel to Representative Farman, have her run the committee meeting, and I'm looking forward to the conversation, members.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I'm really excited today about this opportunity. I have been a school board member. My husband and I own a business, so I've been on our local Chamber of Commerce board of directors. I've been involved in two education foundations. In during all of this, I've understood how important the business community is to our schools and to our children and our economic development in our state. Last year, I was this all came to a head because I was at a few different events that led into one. I had been to the Minnesota Business Partnership Dinner. I had then been to the college or the university at the College of Education and Human Development, where we talked and the conversation was about how the business community and the community at large and the education community are not always talking in the same language. And we really do have the same common goals, but we just don't have that conversation to bring it all together. And then I was asked to speak at the Alliance for Student Achievement. and to give the Republican view of education. And my main message was that education should not be a partisan issue, and that we all have to unite with all of our partners in order to come to our common goals. We may have different solutions of how we get there, but we do need to get there. We talk about having a career and college-ready community, so it's very important to bring in the career part of it. Anyway, when I was asked to speak at this event, I was standing and I was asking the people, I mentioned I had been to this Minnesota Partnership Dinner, and it was all of our education people in the state that were at this meeting. And I asked, how many people knew that the Minnesota Business Partnership, one of their main objectives is education? And I didn't see a hand go up in the room. And that was appalling to me, that the education community was not understanding that the business community was on their side. And that's why I felt today's hearing was very important, to bring everybody into the conversation and understand that we always ask for people's time, talent, and treasure. We can't just go to the business community for their treasure. We need to also get their time and their talent to help with promoting education in our state. So with that, we've invited the Minnesota Chamber, the Minnesota Business Partnership, my cast members, and also the Minnesota High Tech Association to participate in today's hearing. And you don't need to hear me talk anymore, so I'll first ask Steve Waters and Laura Eckholm to come from the representing the Minnesota Chamber.
Representative Farland, I'm going to ask if we perhaps could exchange seats, but just for a second, let's just take care of a little bit of business. If we can have a motion to adopt the minutes of the February 11th meeting.
Mr. Chair, I so move.
Thank you. Representative Defke moves approval of the minutes of February 11th. Any discussion, members? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Defke. And Representative Farland, I'm going to vacate this seat so you can have it.
You just stay right there.
Well, I'm going to slide over and kind of chat a little bit with Lisa Larson for a second.
Okay.
So that's okay.
Please state your name and who you represent, and please move forward.
Good morning. My name is Laura Eckholm, and I am an employee at and part owner of L&M Radiator Manufacturing Company in Hibbing, Minnesota. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Chamber Board of Commerce. Thank you for allowing us to come and speak today. And I would echo McFarland's comments that education is a very important part of what we think about every day. We are a manufacturing company located, headquartered, I should say, in Hibbing, Minnesota. But we have six plants around the world, four in the United States, one in Australia, and a partial ownership of a plant in Mexico. We have our roots in the mining industry. Our major customers are mining and oil and gas industry. We started business 51 years ago in Hibbing, and 100% of our business was in mining on the Iron Range, and today less than 1% of our business is in Minnesota. Since 2003, so about the past 5 years, we've doubled in size. We've gone from 200 employees to nearly 500 employees worldwide. We've doubled in production, we've doubled in space, we've doubled in sales. And of those people that we've added 282 people in the last 4 years. 75 of them are in Hibbing. To realize those 75 new employees, we actually hired 221. So what's our biggest issue? It's hiring quality, qualified employees. A company cannot experience growth like we've experienced without having a skilled and dedicated workforce. In going through this recent growth, we've really gone back to the basics with our hiring. We do background checks, we do pre-employment physicals, but we still have issues with underqualified applicants. I think you were handed out a little math test, and I apologize, it's really hard to read. Normally when we have this printed off at work, it's a bigger size, it's a drawing. But we give this test to at least our welding applicants, if not all of our applicants and all of our plants. And on the right-hand corner, there's a little math test. There's a ruler with some lines, and the applicants are supposed to indicate what the measurement is. And underneath, there are some just very basic fractions and decimal equivalent questions. And 10 years ago, no applicant was interviewed unless they answered all these questions correctly. Now, we're happy when they spell their name right, but it's also if they get less than 5 wrong, that we'll interview them. But because of that, you know, we are a manufacturing environment. You have to know math, and you have to measure every day. It's part of your job. So we've had to do a lot of training. 5 years ago, we got a MJSP grant, which we were really excited to get. We used that money to institute a new employee orientation program. It's a 2-week program that we put our employees through, and the classes, we work with the college, and the classes include safety, blueprint reading, employment skills, but the big bulk of it is really what we call measuring tools or manufacturing math, but it's basic math. We need to get our employees to understand how to add and subtract, how to work with fractions, and how to measure. 4 or 5 years ago, our foreman came to our HR manager and said, can we please hire employees that know how to use a tape measure? And our director said, I'm trying. So we've really had to institute some different programs and work really closely with the high schools in our area in order to get qualified employees. we are in our third year of a work-based learning program, which we created with the Hibbing High School and specifically the shop teacher there. Their advanced welding class comes to our workplace for about 4 weeks, a couple hours a day, and we rotate the students in. We have 4 students at a time, and they work one-on-one with a mentor. They work in our cutting and bending area and our welding area, and we treat the students like employees. They have to clock in and out. They have to wear proper clothing and protection equipment. And for us, this is allowing us to get a recognition, I guess, in the community and with the high school. It also allows us to have a pool of applicants for summer employees, and about 3 or 4 of those kids have stayed on with us full time. So it's been a very successful program for us. And for the kids, it's understanding that the reason they're going to high school, and some of these kids are probably not interested in going on to college, but they need to learn how to, you know, how to do basic math, how to read and write, so that they can have a job when they get out of high school. I guess just kind of in conclusion, what are we asking for? Just really, we need our students coming out of high school to be able to do basic math, and we need them to be able to read and write. I don't know if we could look at grad standards. One of the biggest complaints we get from the teachers that we work with, and we work with the shop programs across the range. We donate material to them. A lot of times we'll help them out with equipment or help them out with repairs. So we have a pretty good relationship with those folks. But not all students are the same. And the biggest hindrance that we hear about is that the kids don't have time in their schedule to take shop classes, and they get discouraged. They're not doing what they want to do. So I guess my final point is just whatever we can do to make sure our kids graduating from high school have that basic math skills and basic communication skills is going to be a help to everybody.
Thank you, Ms. Eckholm. Mr. Waters.
My name is Steve Waters. I am currently Vice President of Sales for a company called Marathon Multimedia. We have 2 offices. Our main office is in Faribault, Minnesota, and our international sales office is in just north of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. We specialize in helping medical and scientific societies provide continuing education for physicians and scientific researchers around the world. We use a suite of professional services and internet-based tools to do that. All of the employees in our company, regardless of job function, are really required to have a basic set of critical thinking skills. My interest in working with the Minnesota Chamber's Education and Workforce Development Committee stems from a personal experience that I had with my youngest stepson as he navigated his local school district. Tested at a high IQ level, yet suffering from a reading disability, my stepson was passed on from grade to grade, never quite having his educational needs met. The Minnesota Chamber is the state's largest business advocacy organization. And each year, the Chamber religiously surveys its membership and the greater business community to gauge the members' public policy concerns. Our surveys indicate that Minnesota's employers are increasingly concerned about the quality of our workforce and the need for a quality workforce. Over the past 5 years, education and workforce issues have jumped from the bottom of our list to one of the top three business concerns. And as some of you are already aware, every June the Chamber conducts 34 policy development sessions across the state to directly hear the concerns of our members. At these meetings, our business leaders validate the survey results by telling us that education and workforce both need improvement now more than ever, just as Laura indicated a second ago. The results of these policy development sessions motivated us to spend the last 18 months conducting our own in-depth research on education issues as they affect the workplace. We met the major stakeholders in our state, teachers' union, the school board members, superintendents, the Department of Education, and various advocacy groups. Simply put, our involvement is due to the fact that our membership deems education to be critically important to our state's effectiveness and competitiveness. Our mutual goal is to improve the economic health of Minnesota in order that businesses will flourish and sustain competitive advantage. I won't go into the details of the research, however, I do want to share with you our conclusions of the things that we feel need to change to truly improve the workforce in Minnesota. First, close the achievement gap. It is ironic that a state that boasts one of the highest graduation rates in the country also has its greatest achievement gap. The expected demographic shift within our state will add even more complexity to this issue in the years to come. Now more than ever, we need each of our students to be prepared for post-secondary education and a changing workforce. Secondly, world-class standards. Minnesota's companies are competing internationally, and so must our students. As the recent TIMSS test results clearly indicate, standards matter. High educational standards, along with high expectations of our students, are absolutely necessary for our students to be successful in life and to be competitive. If our nation and our state want to maintain a competitive edge, Minnesota cannot afford to lose ground or remain stagnant while other industrialized countries surpass us educationally. Third, we must hold the line on the grad test and remediate earlier. This year's 11th graders are the first set of students that must pass the grad test to graduate from high school. The grad test replaces the basic skills test. The basic skills test was a 6th to 7th grade level assessment. The grad test is a 9th or 10th grade level exam. Yet a large number of students are expected to fail the grad test. The legislature has suggested an alternative path to graduation for students that fail the grad test. The alternative route will allow children who fail the grad test to graduate if they pass the required courses, which is already required by law. The Chamber opposes this solution because it lowers the high school graduation requirement below that of the basic skills test. We believe this represents a giant step backwards by making it easier to graduate without the skills needed for most jobs and a post-secondary education. The children expected to fail the test and use this alternative route to graduation are disproportionately minority and low-income students. We believe an alternative path would be a disservice to disadvantaged children. These children will suffer because they will have lower skill levels than their peers, and it will also make it more difficult for them to compete in the job market, and certainly dramatically increase the cost and time spent in post-secondary education if they so choose, because remediation at the post-secondary level will necessitate paying for extra semesters. Also, we believe we should recruit and retain top talent. After parental involvement, there is no more effective predictor of student success than teacher quality. According to a study by researchers at the University of Tennessee, if two average 8-year-old students are given different teachers, one a high performer, one a low performer, the student's performance diverges by more than 50 percentile points within 3 years. Similar studies were done in Dallas and Boston, and they validate the fact that students placed with high-performing teachers progress 3 times faster than students with low-performing teachers. In fact, students with low-performing teachers actually regress. We need your help to ensure that Minnesota students will have the very best teachers in the classroom. We support improving teacher accreditation standards, as well as providing alternative methods of teacher accreditation to allow for industry experts to impact the classroom. The Minnesota Chamber also wants to explore alternative teacher licensure. High-quality teaching candidates who pass the entrance exam can also demonstrate high GPAs or significant work experience, and who have participated in a rigorous training program should have the opportunity to become teachers. The Chamber also supports increasing the rigor of the entrance exam and reforming teacher compensation to attract the best and brightest college graduates into teaching. Last, financial accountability and efficiency. We support efforts to create the kind of financial transparency that makes it easy for the public to understand funding issues. Holding superintendents, school boards, and teachers accountable for student outcomes and the performance of individual school districts. If there is ever a time for innovation, that time is now. The current budget shortfall can be the catalyst for change and refinement. Several ideas that we've heard as business people and we actually like are things like mandating school districts to join together to share services, such as centralized IT services and purchasing, leveraging those things. Taking at least one course online, which is now critical for post-secondary education and, quite frankly, for workforce development. And incentivizing high school juniors who have completed their graduation requirements to graduate possibly a year early and go on to college during the senior year. Businesses must constantly innovate in order to survive, especially when times are tough. They cannot afford to reduce their quality, nor can they decrease customer service. However, when schools look at ways to reduce costs, the suggestions tend to focus on cutting the core services that we expect them to deliver. The Minnesota Chamber wants to work with you to find ways for schools to do more with less. Innovative, cost-effective, creative ideas can enhance, not reduce, the quality of our education system. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I do have some questions here, but we were going to hold questions until after all the presenters have been able to present. Thank you very much. Would Mr. Emery and Mr. Pettengill please come forward? Thank you for coming. Could you please state your name and who you represent?
Yes, good morning. My name is Dick Pettengill. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Allina Healthcare. This is a very important topic to us because we employ over 24,000 people in Minnesota. And so we are interested in being certain that our workforce is prepared, both from entry-level positions all the way up through professionals from registered nurses to pharmacists to physicians. So this is a very timely topic for us.
And I'm Chip Emery. I'm the retired Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of MTF Systems Corporation, a $500 million public company out in Eden Prairie that manufactures testing equipment for every car, truck, airplane, and medical implant that any of you have ever driven in or had in place in your body. So much of the safety of the environment is in fact created right here by companies that exist here in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, and Mr. Chairman for allowing us to speak to you today about a report that was done for the TASCA project and the Minnesota Business Partnership by the McKinsey Company. The report represents the first phase of our project, and you should have a handout that looks something like this, along with an actual copy of the report, which looks like this. So here's the report itself. We're not going to go through the entire report, obviously. We invite you to read it at your leisure. What we'd like to do is highlight it for you and essentially give you the results of what this report has told us. So what we set out to do specifically to learn was to understand, how does Minnesota's education system compare with the best in the world, and what can we learn from that activity about how we improve the state of Minnesota's public education system? And you might ask, well, why do we even care about what the rest of the world is doing? We have enough data on what's going on here in the United States and in this state specifically. But for the Minnesota Business Partnership, most of us as the woman from Hiving just described, compete in the global marketplace. And with that in line, let me take you just for a second to Eden Prairie, where MTS headquarters is located. We have about 1,500 employees around the globe, about 1,000 here in Minnesota. Roughly 400 of those here in Minnesota are degreed engineers, mechanical, electrical, physics, science, math, metallurgy, a large collection of degreed folks. We have about 300 hourly workers, all of which have some form of either technical associate's degree or the equivalent thereof. And, of course, a large collection of accounting, marketing, basic administrative and financial types who help us run that business. 10 years ago, 65% of our customers were in North America. 25% were in Europe, 5% were in Asia. Today and for the last 5 years, a third of our customers are in North America. A third of our customers are in Asia, and a third of our customers are in Europe. We represent the global movement around the economy. We have not changed our location. We have, in fact, grown our business while we have continued to serve the globe around us. But having spent much time in China, in India, in Germany, in Japan, in Eastern Europe, you very quickly realize what we compete against is well-educated engineers, scientists, accountants from around the globe. And if we don't have that pipeline here in Minnesota, we simply cannot continue to exist here in Minnesota. And that's not a threat, it's just a business reality. The fact that we compete effectively in China with Chinese engineers and have grown significant market share there because of the demand for the kinds of equipment we manufacture is solely attributed to the people we hire here in Minnesota. And those people are largely Minnesotans. They're almost all educated in the Minnesota public school system and come up through the secondary and post-secondary ranks. And that is a lifeline for our community. That's why we sponsored this report. That's why we went out trying to find out what do other countries do to make sure we know what we're competing against and help bring those learnings to our state. We're not here to tell you what to do. We're here to pass on our learnings because essentially we have shared goals. We really need the best and the brightest of our student population to be coming up the pipeline to have jobs here in the state. So in several situations, we found lots and lots of strengths here in the state. As you all know, we're recently rated first in ACT scores. We have an 89% graduation rate from our public high schools, the sixth best in the country and around the globe. And frankly, we found the reasons for that was largely due to some things that you folks all did a number of years ago in setting rigorous standards for reading and math and now going on to science. That was highlighted by the TIMS report, the latest one, which I believe you all heard from not too long ago. Much of the results of the growth of our students that have come through the pipeline has been because of those standards. As a state, we lead the U.S. and the globe on educational options, charter schools and the like that allow different ways for students to become matriculate through the system. And as a rule, we found Minnesota provides relatively stable and relatively fair funding. We can all argue about is enough, but when you compare it to global funding activity, it's pretty stable and pretty fair. So I would compliment the legislature, the teachers, the administrators for an excellent job getting us to here. What worries us, though, is what's going on in the future. And specifically, if you look at the performance gaps that exist in our school system today, 38% of the college students coming from our public schools are required to take remedial courses. That's a staggering number. That says if you're coming into the U or MinSCU or some of our private education schools, a good portion of your freshman year is just spent relearning what you should have learned before you come into high school. It's not surprising when you look at the data that says that 71% of our 11th graders are able to read at that level in reading, and only 34% are at the appropriate level for math schools. That's coming through the school system. 22% of our employees are satisfied with the output of our public school system, or said reversely, 78% of our employers believe we need to continue to improve the educational structure of the students that come into the pipeline. As a result of this activity, McKinsey, as it did its worldwide research, recommended three areas that we as business people could and should concentrate on. And those three areas are what you see here behind us. They were specifically to enhance the pipeline of teacher candidates coming into the school system. Secondly, to strengthen the principal leadership in our schools. And third, to use data to drive performance. I'm going to turn the podium over to Dick to talk about those three initiatives. Dick?
Yeah, thank you very much. And once again, Representative McFarland, it's a pleasure to be here. And we welcome the opportunity to engage in the dialogue with the people here and certainly throughout Minnesota to pursue this goal. When I became involved in this, my area of expertise, as I said when I introduced myself, was healthcare. I actually hadn't been associated with an educational system for some time since my youngest graduated from high school 12 years ago. I am a member of ITAFSCA. ITAFSCA is a business-led organization that is concerned about the social and economic well-being of Minnesota, and it was one of those unusual moments when I missed the meeting and suddenly found myself co-chairing an educational task force in case as well. And I must say it has been truly an education in and of itself. I've had the opportunity and the privilege to visit schools. I've been a principal for a day. I spent a day in the St. Paul Public School System. I've met with teachers, I've met with principals, and when I first got into this, I thought it was going to be a very complex and significant undertaking to talk about. So what are the critical levers that we can pull to really assure that we build upon the educational system that we have in Minnesota that we should all be proud of, and to continue to, as Chip indicated, to position ourselves as a world-class leader in education. And one of the things that we didn't want to do was to boil the educational ocean. And when we first got into this and in consulting with a number of people, I was concerned that I would find it difficult to identify those levers. But after getting into the research and the data and the evidence and looking both at other states and other countries, that it became very clear, as Chip indicated, that it's effective teachers, effective principals, and transparency of data. We have a significant issue on our hands in Minnesota, as we anticipate over 40% of teachers will retire by the year 2030. We know that we had, as you heard from our previous presenters, we know that we have educational achievement gaps. My office sits at the corner of Lake and Chicago, and every day I see an achievement gap happening in our neighborhood. And I must say that exists in healthcare as well, and we should be as equally concerned about that. We need to be certain that we're recruiting the best into teaching. I believe earlier this last week that you heard from Peter Hutchinson from the Bush Foundation. I think their data and their evidence is very compelling in terms of where we need to focus our attention. And lastly, that we need to be certain that we have sufficient number of teachers, as was noted earlier, to train in math and science. Our teachers are going to be looking for more opportunities, more flexibility, and improving the value proposition. Having had the opportunity to observe teachers in the classroom, that I'm not certain personally I would have the patience to be an effective teacher, but I have the utmost respect of the quality of people in our classrooms today, and that we need to do everything we can do to support those and really create a value proposition so we get the best and brightest coming into education in Minnesota. The second area is really principals. I had the opportunity to be principal for a day at Anderson School in Minneapolis, where 97% of the kids are getting free lunches. And the principal is spending more time worrying about maintaining properties, running after facilities, compliance issues, performance issues, food service issues, then quite frankly, educational instruction. It was very frustrating for her and it was very frustrating for me to see that our principals are so distracted in terms of the other things that are before them that they don't have the time to invest in ensuring that our teachers are getting the mentoring, the support, the feedback, and the guidance in the classroom that they need to be effective teachers. So we have to do something, and we appreciate your support in helping to fund principal academies. We think that we need to extend that. We have some great principals around the state, and we think with ongoing education and training that we can continue to fill the principal pipeline with quality indicators. And lastly, that we would urge us all to really, and this is not dissimilar to clinicians, for example, in the clinical environment where nurses are fetching and hunting, and that we have to ensure that their primary goal is to support patients. The primary goal of our principal should be to support our teachers, and that we need to be certain that our environments are conducive to doing that. And lastly, And again, analogous to healthcare, this is a significant issue in healthcare, and that's this whole notion of transparency. People are wanting to know what the mortality and morbidity rate is of a cardiac surgeon. And if we can publish that data, we certainly should be able to publish data on the performance of our schools, our teachers, and our principals. Our consumers are looking for it. We should expect it, as you heard from the chamber, that we have to have good measurements. The quote that we have in our document is that you can have data without information, but you can't have information without data. And we need to be certain that we have consistency of reporting, that we have consistency of measurement, and that we have common standards that we can all relate to, and we can see that the academic achievement is, in fact, improving across the organizations in Minnesota. It should be at the student level, it should be at the teacher level, it should be at the principal level, and it should be at the system level. And without that transparency and information, we don't think that we'll be able to gain the leverage and the improvements that we're all seeking in relationship to this. Before turning it back to Chip, I must say, and I was the representative remarks in terms of the opportunity to work together, that I certainly am committed to working with both the elected officials and representatives as well as others, because we have to collaborate, we have to come together as a community to really improve the overall achievement scores of the students of Minnesota.
Thank you, Dick. I would ask you to turn to the page 13 in the actual report, this little schoolhouse with a bell and a flag on top of it. And while you're turning to that, I'd like to relate a little vignette that Representative McFarland reminded me of. 4 years ago, the business partnership decided we needed to do something to be more publicly visible about the importance of the public school system. And we debated long and hard what that was, but we decided what we'd do was school recognition, recognizing that just highlighting a school or two each year didn't change the world, but it might bring more visibility to successful schools and why they're successful and how that can be used as a lesson for us all to go forward. So with the understanding that there is a huge gap in the achievement of our public schools, we chose to recognize only those schools who had a disproportionate number of free and reduced lunch students, that is higher than the average state population, and which schools had actually beat the statewide averages. So that said they were beating all the odds of achieving or closing that gap. We have recognized 6 schools over the last 4 years now. They have all been elementary schools. They have all had typically in the 70-80% of the student population being free and reduced lunch. And they have all substantially beaten the 4th grade, 5th grade reading and math scores consistently over the years. We visited all those schools. We spent a day in the schools. We didn't ask schools to apply. We took the data. Being business nerds, we looked at the data and said the data should tell you what the results were. So we never put out any noise that you could apply for this. We simply looked at the data each year and picked the schools that had done the best. Then we went and visited the schools, and we asked them to tell us, how did you achieve this? I think the basic message that we took away from there, that consistently the principals made the difference in virtually every school. The principals were white, they were black, they were Chicano. They were male, they were female, they were old, they were young. So there's no demographic to this. They were all principals who knew and understood what they had to do to make their school succeed. They all held very, very high standards and expectations of the faculty and of their students. They let nothing get in their way in order to see that all of their students succeeded at their grade level and moved on. So we have evidence that it can be done, that it can be, that gap can be closed. And we as employers desperately need that gap to be closed. If we don't have enough students in the pipeline that we can hire to compete globally, we simply cannot continue to be successful businesses. And let's face it, without successful businesses and jobs, we don't have a role. We don't have a future here. So what we intend to do is, this little cartoon of a schoolhouse is, to continue to work on 4 specific areas. We have 4 task teams, led each by a CEO, to try to achieve the same goal that I'm sure you want, world-class educational system that prepares students for a career and or a job. The first team is to transform traditional teacher preparation. The second is to recruit alternative sources of teachers into that pipeline. The third is to continue to develop and accelerate the development of leadership skills for our principals. And the fourth team is to help build this statewide database that will tell us who is successfully achieving the results by school, by teacher, by student. This is what the business community intends to do. We're not asking for money. We're not asking for legislative support. We're simply communicating to you, we feel we must do this. And we intend to continue to go down these paths over the months and years to come, and would like the opportunity to come back in some future time and tell you how we're doing. With that, thank you very much.
Thank you. We really appreciate that. Next, from the Minnesota High Tech Association. And then we'll have you come back later for questions. Welcome. You could state your name and who you represent.
I will. And Mr. and Madam Chair, thank you for inviting us in today. My name is Mark Klein. I'm a vice president with Acceler Corporation, a management consulting firm here in the Twin Cities. We're based in Boston, but we expanded into the Twin Cities a little over a year ago. Prior to that, I was an executive with Microsoft here locally in the sales team for 7 years, and have had the chance in Minnesota as my home. I've lived here my whole life. So, what I'd like to do today is shed some light on why STEM education is so important to both small companies and large companies. I've had the privilege recently for the last 2.5 years to be part of the Minnesota High Tech Association board on K-12. I chair the K-12 committee. So what that means is, once again, like you've heard before, businesses going out, meeting with educators, meeting with other businesses, and asking the question, what can we do to help? On behalf of the Minnesota High Tech Association, we applaud your efforts on taking on this work and for inviting us to sit at the table and have a conversation. So, the High Tech Association is a non-profit trade association with a mission to support the growth, sustainability, and global competitiveness of Minnesota's technology-based businesses and economy. We have about 350 members in the association. The bottom line for us is we can't achieve, our members can't achieve in the marketplace what they want without a world-class education. And day in and day out, as we're talking with them and educators, we're trying to work on that agenda. So what does a world-class education system look like? And so what we have on the screen here, and you'll see, is what we think is the augmentation of the three R's in terms of reading, writing, and arithmetic with additional three R's, one around rigor, relevance, and relationships. Now, you've heard a lot about rigor and relevance in the last few presentations. What I want to focus on a little bit today is the importance of relationships. A top priority for our business leaders is finding employees who can work in teams and solve problems. And that a student that has the ability to learn that in their education system and reach out and see what it's like in businesses to do that is at a distinct advantage. So schools have to work hand in hand with businesses to provide those opportunities. What I'm here to say in net out is that businesses want to be involved and work as a partner in the education system, and based on our work with educators, they want us involved. The question is, how do we do this in the most efficient and effective way for both parties? So some examples might help. One example is PTC. It's a software company in Boston, but they have a major presence in Arden Hills. They produce CAD/CAM software for engineers. And over the years, they've been very active in the school systems, both locally and in greater Minnesota, providing that software to schools and training to schools. Recently, they partnered with the U.S. Department of Energy for the first annual nationwide Real World Design Challenge. The design challenge centers around an issue facing the aviation industry. And Minnesota was one of 10 states selected to participate in this program to look at a design challenge, getting high school students involved in that, and saying, how would you solve that? So that's pretty important. In fact, the winner of that contest here in the state performance is going to be announced today at 11 o'clock at the Minnesota Air National Guard facility. So it's going to be kind of fun to see that and who won that the competition, because the U.S. Department of Energy will fly out the winning teams to Washington to compete with the other 9 other states for the final award. And we're going to be represented there. That's pretty cool. So another example would be Lockheed Martin. Lockheed Martin has done great work in reaching out. They have 1,400 company employees that logged over 26,000 hours of volunteer time with education-related issues annually. They're coaching and judging first Lego League teams. They're mentoring gifted math students. They're raising money to donate to local middle schools on science projects and for science teachers. They're sending kids to the science museum and much, much more. They realize that their presence in the community is an important one, and that their future in terms of their business and pulling people into their company is really done and served well by being in the community, getting the brand out there, helping the kids learn, and hopefully, having them want to come into their businesses downstream. Now, one other thing that's been going on is the high-tech association relationship with the Minnesota Department of Education. Last year, we had 13 STEM forums. Actually, in 2006, we had 13 STEM forums where over 1,000 students across the state got to learn about science, technology, engineering, and math, and the local businesses and what their needs were for those kinds of skills. And then last year, we had 8 STEM summits that took place roughly last year at this time, a little earlier, where dozens of businesses exhibited in a career fair type event across the state what they were looking for, what their jobs. And kids can understand what a dentist or a doctor does because they've been there. But very few of them understand what businesses need and how they can relate to businesses unless they're there seeing either the businesses provide examples of what they do or opening their doors and letting the students come in that they see the work that's applied to science, technology, engineering, and math. Now, one of the things that came out of that, and I think you have a handout that went out, if I've got it, we're on Get STEM. Mm-hmm. About a year and a half ago, we had the opportunity, as we were forming the K-12 committee, to go out and talk to businesses and ask them about their involvement in education. And businesses are employees. Now, and there's a lot of great employees in our state that want to reach out to help the education system. And so we found that there was a desire for getting involved. The question was at a business level, how do we do that? How do we know how to reach out in schools to get more actively involved? At the same time, we brought in educators. We worked with the Department of Education to bring people in. And we talked to teachers. And we found out things were going really well. We found some struggling going on in some areas. And the question was, well, how do we get connected with business? And so what you have with the Get STEM portal, which went live on February 2nd, is a joint work effort with the Department of Education and the High Tech Association to put a portal out supplied in the back with social networking. We're actually out there trying to incubate and work on relationships where a teacher can just ask and a business can just offer to provide support. Now, since it's launching in February, we've had some over 2,000 people go out there and look at this and start applying and getting involved and asking the question, what do teachers need? What do students need in my backyard? And businesses are able to respond to that, as well as teachers can post requests for anything, number of things, in terms of mentoring, support field trips, and so on. So I really want to maintain our time schedule here. I'd love to get a demo, but I would ask you to go out and look at the STEM site and see what's out there in terms of what asks and offers are going on between teachers and businesses. Because what we're trying to do is incubate and stimulate the conversation and work not just from the top down with you in terms of policies, et cetera, but from the bottom up from a grassroots perspective to help our teachers do the best job that they can. So some closing thoughts.
Mr. Klein, yeah. When you talked about in February, you meant just a few weeks ago, right, that you opened
right.
The site up?
Yes, February 2nd was launched. Yeah. So let me leave you with a couple closing thoughts. First of all, the top 10 in-demand jobs for 2010 didn't exist in 2004. They weren't there. In 1984, the number of devices that connected the Internet was about 1,000, and today it's over 14 billion. It took 38 years for the radio to reach a market of 50 million people. It took the iPod around 3. Facebook, as we all know, about 2, which is interesting. The first text message was sent at the end of the first Bush presidency in 1992. Today, more text messages are sent and received one day than there are people on the planet. I think my youngest daughter contributes heavily to that. The amount of new technology information is doubling every 2 years. This means that half of what a student learns in their first year is outdated by their third year. That's our challenge, as we look at from a business perspective and education perspective, how we build a relationship with the rigor, with the relevancy, to meet our needs in a global economy. So with that in mind, I'd like to just close off and thank you for the time again, and open the floor for any questions.
Thank you. And I'd like to call Mr. Waters up for some closing remarks first.
Thank you. Just to conclude, Ronald Reagan once famously said that, he said, you know, status quo, that's Latin for the mess we're in. Well, that's not the case here. I would say that we're in a mess. We're certainly in a very complex selling and business environment. We're in a very, this is a very complex issue. But the message that we want to leave with you is that business is very unified around this connection between education and workforce. We believe that there are three areas, and we hope we've demonstrated at least some of that to you this morning, that Minnesota does need world-class students and a world-class education for all students. We do not want to lower expectations for achievement, and we want to make sure that we recruit and we develop top talent for our Minnesota schools so that we can compete and sustain competitive advantage. And I think with that, we'll take any questions you have.
That sounds great. And these questions will be open to all of the presenters.
Yes.
Representative Dabney.
And I'll pass the question to Chris. I wanted to ask as well.
Ms. Ekholm had to leave to go out of state again. Okay. Ms. Briner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Waters, my question is for you, and I'll precede this by just saying I have a background very similar to Representative McFarland's. I come off of 12 years on a school board. Before I was on the school board, I was involved in a business education partnership in the Mankato area. We have a career education partnership with our local chamber that's exemplary throughout the state. We have a very high level STEM program that was one of the original STEM programs, and I was involved in shaping that. So I want you to have that background, that I really appreciate what you're doing and that kind of partnership that you represent and your intention in improving the quality of education in Minnesota. But I want to look just briefly at the five, I don't want to talk about each of these, but your five goals from Minnesota Chamber objectives. I believe that four of these are very broadly conceived and have a lot of possible avenues of achievement, but the middle one, hold the line on the grad test, is of a different order, and I don't think it appropriately belongs in this same class, because while the goal behind it, high-level math achievement, I think is of the same order as these other objectives, the grad test itself, the line has yet to be drawn, and it's a pragmatic tool that serves the goal you aim for. And I would just suggest, we've spent a whole day on this in this committee, and I know you've probably been at the table, or your organization has, in other discussions, but I would just ask you to think about the different order of that goal in terms of its the pragmatics of it versus its general objective of achieving high math skills. We, too, are about having our students achieve very high math skills, but it's not clear that this test will serve that objective. And the students who graduate without a diploma will not be, or who don't graduate, will not be well served either, as the students who graduate with a diploma and don't have the math skills. And there's some ground in between, so I'm just asking you about to look at that, and you may have some response to that, but I challenge the appropriateness of this goal among the five of being of the same order.
Mr. Waters, did you want to respond? Or?
Well, certainly, I appreciate the input, and I will tell you that obviously we agree on the ultimate outcome. I mean, that's, in fact, I've met with a few of you independently in other sessions, and I know that we're working towards the same goals. We may disagree on how to get there, but we agree on the basic fundamental goals of that. Yeah.
Thank you. Would the other presenters like to come forward so that you'll be able to answer questions as they arise? Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a variety of questions, but I think I'll stick to one. I'm sure there's others on the list. Mine is for Mr. Emery. I think it was Mr. Emery, anyway, that said that we're not asking for any money, but yet we want quality teachers in the pipeline and Principals Academy and data-driven information and so forth. And those are things that you do need to fund. The governor's asked for funding for some of these things. The most expensive one is the data one. And in the year 2000, we had 5 employees in the Department of Education in testing and assessment. And in the year 2009, we have 25. And as we purchase tests, develop tests, look at, you know, what are the best type of tests, the governor's proposal that I think virtually all of us, if not all of us, in the legislative table support, migrating to computer adaptive tests, which are expensive. We've had testimony from a Dr. Yeh at the university that says we ought to be doing rapid assessments because we shouldn't just measure, we should actually instruct and do something, and that would help with that. But that costs a lot. That's not cheap either, to do the startup and then to maintain. The governor wants $7.5 million more for the testing he's proposing, and that doesn't include the rapid assessment. So I wonder, how is it you're not asking for any money?
Mr. Chairman.
Madam Chairman, Representative Greeling, the purpose of coming here was not to tell you that you need to spend a lot more money in solving these problems. We recognize all these issues are expensive, they're hard to deal with, they're complex issues, and we're all dealing with people. The purpose in us coming here was to tell you the business community is committed to helping participate in this process. Specifically, we would ask that you continue to fund the Principals Academy because it's one of the areas that we think is important. But we've basically said we as business leaders can't just sit back and demand of you solve all these problems while we take the results of the educational system. But it's largely to say we are committed to doing something about it ourselves. And as Representative McFarland said, we have
time, talent, and treasure.
We have time and we have talent. And one of the things that we basically all said, we must figure out a way to give our time and our talent to help improve the teacher pipeline, to help get principals up the pipeline of learning, and to help deliver a better data system. So we weren't here to say put money in different pots. It was more to say we want to help you figure out how to get there.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one follow-up. I appreciate that. So in other words, you're not saying that we don't need more money to do the things that you support.
We're basically saying we think we have enough money in the pipeline, money in the budget. We are well-funded overall, but we just need to figure out how to use that more wisely.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've had a question that I've wanted to ask for a long time, and with business representatives here, maybe this is the right time to ask it, and that is the difference, if any, between career and college readiness. I think we use the terms interchangeably here, and I actually served on the Minneapolis Regional Chamber Board, and it was really shocking to me the survey results that we got back from our large business members versus our very small business members. The large business members tended to be very satisfied with the workforce, and the smaller ones very dissatisfied. And so I'm wondering if there is, in your mind, a distinction between what should happen in the K-12 arena for people who have a career projection versus a college projection, or if those are one and the same in terms of curriculum and outcomes.
You could all have a stab at it if you'd like.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a great question because for us it's both. Because we do, as I mentioned in my introductory comments, as an employer, hire a number of entry-level workers. And I think that the career path that they need to be on is different than beginning to think about going to medical school. It's without exception that probably the fastest growing job category in America, and certainly in the state of Minnesota, will be healthcare workers. And what we're trying to do is to actually go back upstream and begin introducing people in K through 12 to health-related careers, be they entry-level careers or be they a professional track, and begin to get them tied to scholarships and other resources and to guarantee them jobs back at our organization so we provide some inducements to get into healthcare. Because the number of, in healthcare, the number of RN positions that will be vacant by the year 2020 based upon the demands of healthcare will be 900,000. 70,000 primary care positions that are projected to be vacant because we don't have the career tracking and college prep going on right now. So it's for us, it's both.
I think also the response, if I believe the question was about the difference between career and a job, and does that define something different in terms of the educational needs? I think maybe representing the larger employers, we tend to, just like the a speaker from Hibbing, we look a lot at, we expect to be around 20, 30, 40 years from now. So when we bring people on board, we anticipate they are going to have a career with us. Whether they actually do or not is another story. But we tend to look at folks as resources that we need to develop and grow. So we're looking for people who have the basic background and skills that they can have a career at our company and learn and grow. And hence, we're going to train them in education and educate them in the things they need to go to do to understand how to grow in our specific community. Whereas many of the smaller employers may have the same outlook, but just not the resources to do that with.
Thank you, Mr. Emery. Does anybody else want to speak to that question?
A great question. In having left 78,000 of my closest friends at Microsoft to join a 30-person consulting firm recently, that is a challenge. And in fact, it gets back to the notion of us as businesses being actively involved, reaching out to schools and colleges to help them understand the differences between graduating with the academic skills, but also understand how businesses work and what the opportunities are for them. In fact, I'm leaving here to go to the University of Minnesota to speak to an AMA marketing club that has 30 students that are graduating this year who are very much interested in how do I get into a small business? What can I, what value do I bring, and what do I have to learn to be an entrepreneur? And so I think to answer the question, you need the academics, clearly. But we have to reach out and make it real to the students of what the world's about so they can make choices and we can help them get into our company in a faster, better way.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Mr. Waters, did you want to say anything there?
Only from the standpoint of the Minnesota Chamber, the majority of our members represent smaller businesses. Approximately 80% of our membership represents smaller businesses. And a lot of those businesses do have a challenge in hiring entry level workers, and so there is that need for some rigor on the education side. Many of the larger employers, and I've worked for larger employers myself, they're able to attract talent from all over the place, all over the world actually. Whereas entry level jobs are not necessarily the same class.
Representative Downey, did you have another question? Okay, thank you. Representative Beecher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On Bloom's hierarchy of problem-solving skills, my questions are on the lowest level, I think, compared to the questions that were asked previously. So quickly, Mr. Emery, had the schools that you award each year, had those principals you spoke to the value of those principals in that building, had those principals been through the Principals Leadership Academy?
Mr. Emery.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Dietrich, best of my knowledge, no, they had not been. I guess you could just leave it there.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Klein, you talked about problem-solving skills needed in the workplace, and I would consider problem-solving skills along with the other 21st century skills. But when, I don't know if you have done any work on looking at our standards, and do you think that our standards include problem-solving skills? Or do you think they are more knowledge-based?
Well, I can't speak as an expert. I've had a chance to go and see several schools that are doing a cross-disciplinary type of work where they're trying to bring science and math and English together to solve problems. And I've seen wonderful examples of teachers with principals bringing that kind of curriculum in. And what I've learned by observing that kind of approach is the problem-solving skills and the interdisciplinary kind of approach seems to be working really well. And the kids, at least at the high school level, where I've seen this, they do amazing work. I mean, critical thinking, problem-solving, cross-discipline, reaching out and solving problems. So I can only speak that to the degree that that kind of work continues in the schools and the businesses provide real-life examples in terms of problem-solving to apply that to, it's good news.
Yes, I would agree. Follow-up, Madam
Representative Beecher.
Thank you. And maybe Mr. Klein would want to speak to this too. This is kind of a piggyback off of Representative Gradling's comment about money in the schools, and that there should be enough money in the schools the way that they are. But I think that all of you, at least in my own interpretation, have called out for modernizing a little bit, possibly, our schools and creating 21st century skills. And the one area that I would say that we are not up to date in is in the area of technology. And I think that we need to beef up the technology in all of our schools throughout the whole state if we really want our kids to compete. And our teachers to have actual data to make real decisions on, and our principals to assess their schools and that type of stuff. So I guess my question is do you have any comments on that? Are our kids coming out technologically adequate, or do you think that that is something that that should be shifted or rethought? Any thoughts on that?
Mr. Klein, and then I'll let the others respond if you'd like.
Madam Chair, thank you. Well, it's interesting because the children that are graduating today have more technology in their hands than we had in the back rooms of our companies 15, 20 years ago. So on one hand, they have access to and are using a lot of that technology. The question is, how do businesses re-engineer their approach with the workforce? We have the same challenge in terms of how do we adapt to bring people in with new skills and expectations about the tools they use. And we do need to bring more technology to schools and use it appropriately. There are many schools, I spent time at the Minnetonka School District last year, where they're bringing in the whiteboard technology, the computer technology. And it's fundamentally changed the teaching experience and learning experience for the children there. So I think it's a balance of both. But I think we have to realize that it's not just about what we're putting in the schools, but our children have access to things now in their hands and how they work and live daily. That's going to change how businesses have to work and bring them in and use their skills and abilities as well. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, let me make a comment on this. As I was conducting my travels and learning about the educational community, it seemed like every educator I met with gave me a book to read on education. And one book was Christensen's book, who wrote Disruptive Innovations. But he's also written a book called Disrupting Classrooms. And he talks to this very issue about how we're using technology in classrooms. If you look at the ratio of computers to students, that's gotten very small. His thesis is, and it's somewhat controversial, is that we're not using technology appropriately. What we're using technology to do is reinforcing outdated educational processes rather than discovering new ones and using it in a disruptive way to get people connected to educational processes in a different way. He talked about this one example of a young high school girl who wanted to take a Arabic course, and because her school couldn't teach it, they couldn't use it. But they did have technology in the school, and eventually they got her connected to a technology class in London over the internet. So it's the way you use technology, I think, that is the relevancy to your question. His argument is that we're not using it as creatively and as disruptively as we should.
Interesting. Thank you.
Anybody else want to speak to it? Thank you. Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a brother that's got a master's degree in quantum physics. When he was in the master's program down in Iowa State, he got an award for being a great teacher, and he now works for a computer program company, makes in the range of $100,000. Some of the programs that you talked about, you admit, are going to take a lot of money to do that. What are we going to do in schools? What are we going to eliminate so that we can afford to pay teachers $100,000 to attract somebody like that, which would be one of the brightest and best, one of the best people we could get into the education system? But I don't think we expect him to take a 70% cut in pay to do that. So, you know, what are we going to get rid of so we can afford to pay teachers that, you know, $80,000, $90,000 we need to get those brightest and best? And what are we going to cut or eliminate so that we can add some of the programs that you're talking about?
Who would like to speak to that?
Well, I'll take a shot at it, Madam Chairman, Representative Holt. I don't have a crystal ball to tell you the specifics. I'm not an educator in the classic sense. What I do know is there are going to be a significant number of teachers leaving the profession here in Minnesota over the next decade, and the population of the state isn't growing at a rate that's going to demand all those be replaced. Some of that can come from just attrition. I think the second way to fill some of those activities, and specifically in the area you cited, STEM education, is the use of individuals, perhaps like myself, who've had a career in math or science and want to go back and teach in the public school system, but don't have a certificate to teach, don't expect to make $100,000, but have something that I can give and bring to support STEM education in the public school system. And that goes to alternative ways of getting teachers into the pipeline. I don't think there's any magic answer that's going to take a $100,000 to $150,000 scientist and get him to go to teach in schools other than pure altruism.
Did anybody want to speak to
that? Yes, Madam Chair. I think that's a great question. And the way I would approach it is similar to the way we approach it in our business, and that is, how do we drive out unnecessary variation in performance? And when is innovation and variation a source of discovery of new knowledge, and when isn't a source of inefficiency? We do have a chart in our report that we've prepared on the ratio of administrative expenditures toward versus teachers in the classroom. I would have to pose the question to the Educational Institutes of Minnesota, have we driven out all the inefficiency and achieved the level of standardization that we can on administrative processes to be certain that we're using our scarce dollars to invest in teachers in the classroom? Having traveled around and visited a number of schools, my observation would be, no, we haven't, and so that's where I would head.
Thank you. Does anybody else have any questions? Representative Graham.
Thank you, Madam Chair, as long as we get around to question number two. Was it Mr. Emery that was talking about Christensen's book, Disrupting Class? No, that's you. Okay, this is for you then. I was hoping it was him, but
I can answer it. That's all right.
Because I am the education finance chair, and so I always want to know about these things. Okay, you were proposing to support having more technology per Representative Dietrich's question, and cited the Arabic class that was needed for the students to do well. And the governor in his State of the State asked that all students take an online class as a part of their high school experience, you know, to get people to doing that and to get schools, I suppose, to be offering more classes. And I strongly support that as well. And it sounds like we all do. But then when we got the governor's budget, we noticed that despite his lofty words, he allocated $1 million to start working on the problem that Representative Dietrich cited, that we don't have the capacity in this state for students all around the state to be able to profit from online learning. And hence, he put off the idea that we would do that, we'd start working on that with the $1 million, and then later, sometime later, we would get around to asking students to all take an online class. And so I'm wondering if you or Mr. Emery would support, as Representative Dietrich was asking, more funding so we could provide that infrastructure so all students would have that opportunity. In the Disrupting Class, which a lot of us received that book from, I think, Ted Coldery, so we had a chance to read it over the summer, those of us who are incumbents, it said that, we are near the tipping point, and soon, not because we think a computer is better than a teacher, but because a computer class is better than no class. And if you have a class you want and need, and it is not being offered because your school is short of money, then you need to take that class. But then we get to this Catch 22 where we don't have the infrastructure in the state. So I'm wondering if at least that you see a need for more funding, or if Mr. Emery does.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Goulet, I may have either not been clear or misstated. I didn't mean to imply, because I don't have the data to support this, that we have to invest more in technology. The argument that Christensen makes in his book is that we need to do a better job of using the technology that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So the proposition that I would put forth is that, have we made any observations as to how we are, in fact, using the technology, and can we reallocate the use of it to achieve the goal without having to invest additional funds that are so scarce and limited at this time?
Representative Ryan?
Sure. Well, certainly we need to use the funds we have wisely, but I was talking about the capacity for districts that don't have that capability.
I believe that
it doesn't sound like it's going
to
do it.
I believe Mr. Emery wanted to respond also.
I would suggest that going back to the basic data and the reason we are so concerned about the pipeline as employers is that the number of school systems who are in the middle of that gap. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to make a dent in improving that gap,
put those resources there. Pick an area where we can have a fairly near-term and immediate impact by online delivery of some kinds of education, and put in school systems that can most benefit from it early and learn from it that way. It would be wonderful if every school and every student could get online learning immediately. Whether that's the solution to all our problems, I don't know. But it certainly, if there's a minimal amount of money to be spent on that, putting it in the place where the need is the greatest would be the place where I would go to solve that problem.
Representative Ryan, did you have another question?
Well, Madam Chair, I have a lot, but maybe someone else has one. Okay. If not, come back to me as soon as
okay.
Right away.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask about a concept that's actually turning into bill form around here, focusing on site-based governance and giving greater autonomy to the individual school, the principals and the teachers, and a specific proposal, again, that I've actually signed on to that would allow site-based governance with about a 15% administrative overhead allocation to that local school, but to kind of subcontract for administrative services from the district. Was there anything in your research or anything in your conclusions that you have drawn that would say giving schools more autonomy, allowing the teachers and the principals to run their local buildings and their curriculum, that would perhaps further some of your agenda, or did you not see anything along those lines?
Who would like to answer? Mr. Patton?
I'll give a perspective on it, Madam Chair. And as I stated when we provided the highlights of our report, we really tried to stay focused on a number of areas. Although we discussed governance, we didn't come out with any recommendations per se on governance. Certainly, when you look around the country at other communities that have tackled a K-12 educational reform, many have, in fact, taken governance as the key issue, and many have drawn the conclusion that the closer you can get the decision-making around governance allocation of resources to local school, the higher the probability is you're going to come away with a wide set of decisions.
Anybody else want to address that? Okay. Representative Swales.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I really appreciate all of the information and work that you brought this morning. I think it's very important and very timely. And I really do appreciate especially the emphasis on principal leadership in schools. Over my 25 career, I have worked for wonderfully, you know, people-oriented leaders, and I have worked for tyrants. But I can tell you that the ones that really value staff development, they look at their individual teachers and their individual gifts that they bring to the classroom and provide opportunities for those teachers to grow and develop, are the ones that get the best results in the schools. So I just really applaud that emphasis that you're doing and hope that as we continue to develop leadership across the state, that we are really investing in that kind of pressure reliever for teachers. We, you know, in the classroom, we're under a scenario right now. The reality is that families are under stress, and children don't always have the maturity or the abilities to deal with the stress that their families are facing. And even though I teach high school, and these young people are more mature than the little children in elementary school, they bring those stress factors with them. And I think it takes people who are really tuned in and keyed in on the needs of their community and the needs of the families in their communities. And I hope that as the businesses are working with education, that we can keep all of that kind of in focus, that there are stress factors on families that did not exist 10 years ago or 20 years ago.
Would anybody like to respond? Mr. Emery.
Thank you, Representative Swales, Madam Chairman. The focus on principals was part of our own activity that we developed appreciation for over the past 4 or 5 years, but it was also the result of the McKinsey study that said that is the center of power and direction and leadership in virtually every building, and if that leadership is not foresightful and providing the kind of direction that building and collection of people needs, it fails in many cases, and hence the data supported what we were intuitively seeing. The six principles that we have recognized, I don't believe any of them went through that principal leadership program, and we thought as we were thinking through this, how can you copy those people? How do you copy those six folks and move them into similar kind of positions, or clone them, as you will? And that's what the principal leadership activity is all about, to get those principles and ideas in the heads of people coming into the pipeline to be principals, or to help reinforce things that people are dealing with on a day-to-day. I had the great good fortune to mentor an up-and-coming principal through one of these programs myself. And in a discussion with him a month ago in a school which is basically focused on parents with children in the school system. The kids have kids that are in the school system. And it was just very interesting to me. His basic question is I see how the current leader of the school manages things, and it's overwhelming how many things that person has to manage. How do I deal with that? Well, unless you've had some experience in dealing with that, he very honestly said, I can see if I ever become a principal, I'm going to sit in that office and push paperwork all day long, because that's what you do. He says, intuitively, I know that's wrong. How do I find a way out of that? And of course, the mentoring part of a business person, we have the same issues every day. How do you deal with that? So it's, again, connecting business to principles about leadership and management are skills that are common to virtually every occupation. And the extent we as business people can help transfer our knowledge and skills into people who either are principals or are becoming principals, we think we can make a huge impact. And that's part of the reason why we aren't asking for money. It's resources, time, talent. And you have a ton of it in this state. And most of us, if you ask us, are more than willing to help.
Mr. Waters, could you just wrap it up in a minute?
Yes, I'd like to validate with what Mr. Emery just said. In fact, he and I are both involved in mentoring principals. And the principal that I'm working with is in North Minneapolis, and that particular school district, many of the students that are coming into the district are in this particular school are two and sometimes three grades behind. And there are tremendous pressures on the family. But this gets back to making sure we're retaining the right type, hiring and retaining the right type of teachers. It takes a special person to be able to train and instruct those students. They have found that they've had teachers come in from other schools and have not been as successful because they don't understand those pressures. But this is an area that I think that business and education can work hand in hand. We do have an opportunity to mentor these folks that are guiding these teachers. They are dealing with many leadership issues that we face every day in business, and I think this is a great place where we can donate a lot of our time and effort.
Thank you. Oh, we're running out of time, and I do have a lot more people that wanted to ask questions, so I hope that you'll ask some of the presenters or anybody who belongs to your local chambers or the Minnesota Business Partnership, all of the groups that participated today. I also wanted to thank Charlie Weaver for being here today and for the White Bear Chamber that came today to be here. And please, I thank you very much, the presenters, for being here. We need to be partners with you, and thank you again. And this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.